Moby Dick is one of the greatest American novels, maybe the greatest, or so we've been told. It's large, ambitious, sprawling, digressive, brimming with sea lore and symbolism, and it can be daunting to read. And frankly, many of us know it best from the cliff notes we use in high school. Now, National Book Award winner Nathaniel Philbrick asks a question that many of us asked ourselves when we were 17 in the title of his latest book, Why Read Moby Dick? It's published by Viking, and I'm very pleased that it brings Nathaniel Philbrick back to our show. Hello.
It's great to be here.
When did you first read Moby Dick?
I, like many people, read it as a senior in high school.
A school assignment?
School assignment, and I very reluctantly, because my father is a retired English professor with a specialty in American literature, and that was the book he was always crowing about. So as a teenager, a rebellious teenager, that was the last book on earth I wanted to read.
Did you make it through it completely the first time?
Call Me Ishmael just drew me in, and I was, you know, it was what sort of complex situation where I had to say, Dad, yeah, you are right. And it, from the beginning, the book really drew me in.
Have you read it many times since?
Yeah, I think close to a dozen times. It's a book I come back to very regularly. I dip into. It's a real repository of all sorts of things.
Well, didn't you have to read it as part of your research when you wrote In the Heart of the Sea, which tells the true story of the whale ship Essex that inspired Moby Dick?
Yeah, and that was a very tricky thing because the shadow of Moby Dick is vast. And to write a book, a nonfiction book, about something that was so integral to the creation of that novel meant that I had to keep Melville at a distance, and it was a real challenge.
Well, when you started doing your research, did you find that Melville pretty much knew the story well?
Yeah. The more you get to know about whaling and look at Moby Dick, you realize that Melville really knew his stuff. He had been out there for a couple of years as a whaleman, but had also read everything going into it. And so that he was, it's a great, great whaling book.
On the other hand, In the Heart of the Sea is an easier read.
Well, it tells a survival tale.
Was Moby Dick what first got you started in telling the story?
Yeah, Moby Dick was a book that really got me interested in it, but it was really moving to Nantucket in 25 years ago in 1986 that made me see Moby Dick in a new way and then made me see where I lived in a very new way.
Well, did you move to Nantucket as part of a writing project? Or
no,
just,
it was not that romantic. My wife is an attorney, and she got a job offer there. I knew very little about Nantucket except for what I had read in Moby Dick. And one of the things I had read, I had assumed that Melville knew all sorts of things about Moby Dick, about Nantucket.
And he does, doesn't he? He has a whole chapter on it.
Yes, but he had never visited Nantucket before writing that. And that was really crushing to me when I learned that a few years after moving to Nantucket. But that sort of shows you the power of, you know, his imaginative engagement with his materials.
But was he accurate, or was he researcher?
In chapter 14 of Moby Dick, which is a five-paragraph tour de force, he creates this image, this poetic cultural image of Nantucket that is not wrong, but it's not of this world.
Well, he had also, as you said, gone out to sea. He from another town, I assume.
From New Bedford. He
from
knew
New
Nantucket.
Bedford. Why didn't he just write about New Bedford?
Well, he it begins in New Bedford, but he wanted to go back, as Ishmael says, to the great original, to the original whaling port. And, it's all about symbols and icons, and Nantucket is that.
Now, let's be honest. It's difficult to imagine a book called Why Read the Great Gatsby or Why Read Huckleberry Finn. We don't need any urging.
Yeah,
but we need urging here?
Yes. I think of all the classics, Moby Dick is the most reluctantly read. It is so long. It is digressive. Just when you think you're figuring out where it's going, Melville throws in a short chapter about something completely different. And it's a real challenge. It's a book I find later in life, when you have some life experiences to bring to the book, you begin to see it in a different light.
But some people do find some of those chapters tedious. There are chapters on chowder, on the whiteness of a whale, on ambergris, which is whale vomit.
Yeah, well, I think I love that stuff personally. But what I found, my last time reading this book was I was on a book tour, and so I was in airplanes, and what I found was those little chapters were actually very conducive to airport reading. They're not that long. They are their own little sidebars, and taken together, they really create a narrative momentum that can take you through a 2-month reading process.
Did he feel that it was important for the reader to have all that context?
Yeah, this book.
Because he didn't do that in other books.
To a limited extent, he did, but no, this is different. I think he wanted to contain all the wisdom of the world in this book. It is like the Bible in that way.
Or an attempt to write the great American novel before that became a cliche.
Yeah. And it's a book that's written for the future. In a way, it didn't get much of a response when he published it in 1851. But it's, I think, part of the process is it contains so much that it really had to have some distance from its own time for all those individual chapters and all those elements to have their own space.
Well, there are two other options. One is to read an annotated version. Another is to read an abridged version. Did either of those slow the story or speed up the story in a way that's acceptable to you?
Well, you know, I'm not a purist, but I really do think you need the text. And I don't think you need to necessarily read it all the way through. Dipping into it works wonderfully because of this small chapter structure.
Well, you mentioned the biblical aspect. There's a lot of biblical symbolism in it. Was he a particularly religious man?
He had a religious sensibility, but he wasn't entirely sure what he believed, I think. There was a dark skepticism, bleak skepticism in his soul, but he was always questing. And his friend and fellow author Nathaniel Hawthorne commented on that aspect of his personality. And so that spiritual questing nature is all over the book.
But he was also writing it for an audience that would have been a lot more familiar with the text of the Bible than
absolutely.
And most modern readers. I mean, there are people who know the Bible today from beginning to end, have memorized it. But that was just a part of the general culture in Melville's time.
And it does. It makes it potentially difficult for a modern-day audience. He's also channeling Shakespeare, Milton, all sorts of literary references that an earlier audience might have gotten some of the references too, but it also creates its own language in a very profound way. That is, it's almost an American language that I think sort of transports the Bible, Milton, and Shakespeare into something that's very American.
Well, he starts us off with a reference to the Bible, "Call me Ishmael."
Right. And, who is this Ishmael?
And why do you think that line has become so famous? It's not...
Well, it's
that
a what
brilliant is it?
Well, just think about it. It's like, hey, call me Ishmael. It's very familiar, but Ishmael, who is this Ishmael? It's beguiling and yet mysterious, and he does it with that, with three words. It's really hard to beat.
Who is Ishmael in the Bible?
Ishmael in the Bible had been kicked out of the family and was forced to wander the desert, and so obviously this Ishmael of Moby Dick is wandering the seas of the world.
Well, and sailors often felt that way, didn't they?
Absolutely.
So many people went out to sea because they were leaving family problems. Later, people joined the military.
Right. It was the refuge for young people. And Moby Dick has a chapter really about that, that there's a whole breed of young men who are seeking their fortune on the ocean.
Is that what Ishmael's looking for when he goes to sea?
He's been doing this for quite a while, we find out. And he says in the early chapters of Moby Dick that he's fascinated by almost a platonic idea, the great idea of the white whale itself.
Well, how is that different from Ahab's vision?
Well,
quest?
Well, there's certain similarities. Ahab's quest is one of revenge. He's not necessarily out there to sort of see the world as to accomplish his mission, which is to get the whale that took off his leg and therefore solve all the riddles of the universe.
What happens to Ishmael in the chapter about the whiteness of the whale?
Well, he gets overcome with a terrible bleakness. The whiteness of the whale is something absolute no color, without any of the positive aspects of life. And in that, Ishmael is basically depleted of his initial buoyancy and conviviality, which is so apparent in the early chapters.
My guest is Nathaniel Philbrick, whose latest book is a rather slim volume about a very thick volume. It's called Why Read Moby Dick, and it's published by Viking. This book was published, Moby Dick was published, as you said, in the 1850s. This is before the Civil War. America is involved in a great debate about white and black at the time.
Yeah, and Melville channels all of that in his book. In 1850, when he was working on Moby Dick, the fugitive slave law had just been enacted, which meant that if a slave escaped from the southern states and was found in the north, they had to return the slave, which was never had been the case. And this meant that suddenly slavery was not just a local southern issue, that the entire nation was involved. And so riots were breaking out in Boston. Melville's father-in-law was a judge involved in those riots. And so there was all the turmoil that would climax with the Civil War was very apparent there, really in its ultimately climactic stages. And because of that, you get a sense of a catastrophe always imminent in that book. And, you know, and we're always living with a catastrophe that's imminent.
Well, how does he deal with black characters in this book?
Well, this book is, I think, unique for its time in that since Melville had been out there as a young seaman and worked side by side with sailors of every racial background, this book is wonderful in its all-inclusiveness. When he's Queequeg, for example, is someone that becomes his best friend. There's Dagoo. The
Queequeg is a cannibal.
Cannibal. He's from South Sea Islander. South Sea Islander.
And Ishmael actually shares a bed with him. That's
right.
And putting a lot of trust.
A lot of trust. And in 1851, that is a pretty remarkable thing where he says, hey, I was frightened of this man, but I realized I had more to fear from a drunken white man than from this cannibal.
There's also Pip, the black cabin boy.
Right.
And that refers directly to slavery, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, slavery is all over this. Pip loses his mind when he's thrown from a whaleboat and not rescued until hours afterwards. And he becomes Ahab's confidant, sort of like the fool of Lear. And all sorts of issues there are clearly percolating.
You make a comparison of Queequeg, the cannibal, worshiping his idols, and Melville writing Moby Dick.
Yes.
How are they similar?
Well, in the early chapters, the Nantucket chapters of the novel, Queequeg locks himself in the room in the boarding house and spends a day worshiping his idol. And Ishmael becomes terrified that he's committed suicide, that, you know, something's terribly wrong, and finally busts down the door and sees Queequeg worshiping his idol. And we know that Melville's mother had great anxieties for him locking himself in his study. And once again, I think you're seeing Melville work himself into a lot of these characters, and that's why they continue to have such resonance today.
What was the significance of the sea for Melville, and how is it similar or different to Joseph Conrad's?
Yeah, the sea for Melville is not only something that brings all sorts of excitement and adventure, which you see Ishmael delighting in, but you also it's something that's really scary. And
because it's the unknown.
It's the unknown, and this is where the Essex disaster, where survival cannibalism was a terrible thing, is lurking in this book, and that the sea is a wilderness, and a wilderness is something that has great potential for adventure, but in the end is a heartless killer of humanity.
You say there's also a lot of humor in Moby Dick. Why do you think that most people reading it don't get that?
Yeah, it's absolutely hysterical. Some of the early chapters are quite funny, but he also, in some of these sidebar chapters that people have such trouble with, there's some wonderful jokes snuck into those, and I urge everyone, if you search them out, they are really hilarious.
And they're still funny today? Because
yes.
That's a problem with humor often.
Absolutely. And
it doesn't always age well.
Particularly in the early Nantucket chapters when they're trying to find a whale ship, there are some exchanges between the whale ship owners and Queequeg and Ishmael that really are timelessly funny.
Can you give us an example?
Well, at one point, one of my favorite jokes is that Ishmael is trying to convince the owner to hire Queequeg. And the owner is a Quaker, a Quaker with a vengeance, as Melville calls him, has a hard time with names and is convinced that Queequeg's name is Quahog. And it just becomes hilarious as they go back and forth with that name. And, you know, it could be Groucho Marx for you know, but it was written in the 1850s.
Now, there's a lot of symbolism, a lot of metaphors. Obviously, the biblical references, we have to know who Ahab is. We have to know who Ishmael is. Again, it seems to me an annotated version might not hurt a lot of readers. But was that the way Melville approached writing anyway? Like the white whale itself is a huge metaphor.
Right.
Not well, just an animal.
He had sort of two sides to his brain. He had one that was almost journalistic in its ability to put reality on the page. And, you know, Moby Dick is really grounded in the reality of whaling of the 19th century. But on the other side was this tendency towards vast symbolism. And with this book, I think compared to some of the earlier ones where he really let that metaphoric side get out of control, the reality is holding the things in. And it's a wonderful combination of being rooted to the ground and yet aspiring into the clouds.
And rooted to the ground to the point where he includes a recipe for chowder.
Yes.
I don't know if this is the first novel that ever did that. Unfortunately, too many have since.
There is actually a Nantucket novel written, Miriam Coffin, which was a source for Melville, which I think has a reference to chowder. But just as a side note, I think restaurants and anyone wanting to make some quintessential New England chowder should look at the recipe in the early chapters of Moby Dick. It's perfect.
A lot of listeners have been writing in to tell us how much they love the book.
That's
although they all say the same thing, and I resisted it first. If you can get through it, blah, blah, blah. John in Manhattan writes, as a 9-year-old boy, I was fascinated with all the things about the sea and adventure, read Captain's Courageous 2 years before The Mask and Moby Dick, among others. I started rereading Melville's novel a few years ago, and my first thought disappeared from my screen. But he obviously learned things about it in rereading it that he didn't the first time he read it as a sea adventure.
Well, for me, that's why I can reread this book, because every time you go back to it, it's like it's a new book. So much of life experience changes how you approach Moby Dick, and because it is a repository, there will always be something new to discover.
Now, I gather that you're going to be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Upper East Side Barnes & Noble store on East 86th Street.
Yes.
And I'm assuming that most of the people who are going to show up actually love Moby Dick. I'm just wondering about whether people, if college kids find out about your book, whether they will think it's okay to just simply read your book, learn everything they need to know about it, and not embarrass themselves at a cocktail party.
Well, I feel like a failure if that's how it's used, because the whole point of writing this book was to get, you know, I don't care if you just quit after one page of my book, pick up Moby Dick.
And the book is Why Read Moby Dick. It is published by Viking. My great thanks to Nathaniel Philbrick for joining us today.
Thank you.